Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench.
Hello and welcome back to Fighting on Film. We're here at the IWM Duxford with Dr. Hattie Hearn, the curator of the American Air Museum here at Duxford. Hattie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I think we'll start things off by asking, what do you think, as the curator of the American Air Museum here, what do you think of the show so far?
Well, it's when we first heard that the Masters of the Air was finally getting off the ground, It was so exciting because I think, like a lot of your listeners, I'd been waiting for them to actually get filming for so long. So it was really exciting when it actually started to come out. And I've watched the first few episodes, and I mean, I'm really impressed. I know a lot about the story already, obviously, having that background knowledge. But actually to see it come to life has been incredible. I mean, it's one thing reading about stories of air combat and listening to veterans talk about it, but actually seeing it brought to life is a completely different experience. Yeah, so I was lucky enough to go to London for the premiere.
Very cool.
And we,
wow.
Yeah, yeah, nice. That was really cool. And we watched the first episode, and watching it on the big screen was amazing. It was so immersive. And in terms of historical accuracy, I've been really impressed. And having listened to some of the producers and directors talk about the series and the efforts they went to making sure it was as accurate as possible, I was super kind of impressed with how much effort they put into it. It's been gripping, it's been engaging, and I've loved how they've got like the nuances of the kind of the emotional impact of air warfare, and the relationships between the crew members, and also they've also started to touch upon the relationships with the local British people as well. I've been really, really impressed so far.
So was there any involvement with the production on the museum's part?
So during pre-production, John Orloff and a couple of the other writers came to Duxford, and they went into the B-17, and I think that was the first time they'd been inside a B-17.
Oh, wow.
So that kind of informed their script writing and gave them a sense of what it would have been like to actually work in one of these. And then we also consulted on some of the scenes setting with, we talked to the set dressers and wardrobe and things to make sure that they were as historically accurate as possible.
Oh, that's cool. So there was some involved.
Yeah, which nice. Was cool. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, here we're in the waist positions, so we've got our two waist guns. In earlier models of the B-17, these were completely back-to-back, but they quickly found that when you're kind of operating a 50 cal machine gun with two people back-to-back, you're going to bump into each other, so that's why they separated them. We'll get into the various vulnerabilities of the different crew positions. I think that's a later question, so these guys would have been covering each side of the B-17, looking out for enemy fighters. And then we've got the ball turret down here, which is obviously quite an iconic feature of the B-17. See that in episode 3, when Babyface gets stuck in the ball turret.
Quite harrowing.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah. I think that was every ball turret gunner's greatest fear, that they'll be stuck. There are actually a couple of mechanisms to get out. So there's you could actually open it from the outside. Obviously, there's a hand crank. Also, when you're in the ball turret, if you put your guns downwards, then that would open up the hatch as well. And there's also a hatch on the outside. It's a scary place to be, that's for sure. It's pretty tricky to actually navigate the way.
I can't imagine what it must have been like trying to navigate through while it was in the air.
Yes. This is the radio operator's compartment. So we've got all the radio equipment. So it was here that the radio operator could communicate with other planes. So you could patch the pilots through to the other aircraft in the squadron. And also the control tower. He also could control the intercom system, so all of the crew members had throat mics and headphones so that they could hear each other, because there was no way that anyone was actually going to be able to hear each other over the sound of the bomber. So they all had to have communication equipment. And each crew member could plug into the intercom system and that through various outlets at each of the different positions. And we've got oxygen bottles here, which each crew member would have been attached to. So oxygen was absolutely vital at the type of altitudes they are flying at. And if they didn't have oxygen, then they'd probably be passed out within kind of 3 to 5 minutes. Mm. So yeah, it was hugely important. And one of the most common actual causes of death in a B-17 bomber is lack of oxygen.
Wow. One thing we see on the show quite a bit is the use of flares. When they're in the air. Is that to avoid using the radio to contact other parts of the group?
So at some point they might have had radio silence. Mm. But also the flares was just an easy way to group onto each other. So often when they had to form up over Britain, they were doing so in completely kind of clouded conditions. So the best way to actually see where each group is to use flares. Also, different coloured flares indicated different things. So if they had wounded on board, they would fire a red flare, and that let the people on the ground know that they needed to prepare the ambulances and kind of get everything in position for an emergency landing.
Mm.
Wow. So what's your favourite part of a B-17 then?
Well, that's a really difficult question. I think every part has its kind of unique features. I mean, the cockpit is obviously iconic, so we'll take a look at that in a second. But probably my favourite bit is the nose of the aircraft. We could head over there and I can
absolutely
talk through that.
Yeah.
Just going through the bomb bay now. You can imagine if the bomb bay doors were actually open and you had to walk in this walkway, it would be a little bit...
It's amazingly cramped.
Yes,
I mean,
it is.
The audio is probably not doing it justice, but it's so tight. You know, I'm a short man, I'm not a thin man, but I can imagine what it's like when you're fully in your flight suit.
Yeah, I think this gantry is about 6 inches wide.
Incredible. Real squeeze.
The scenes where they come through and pull out the
tins.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite get across how
small this. Oh my gosh. No, it really doesn't. Incredibly, incredibly tight. Oh wow. Do you want me to come down, Hattie?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can imagine with all the fight gear.
Oh yeah, just going down to the the bombers. There's that famous bomb site right in front of us now. Oh wow, bit of a squeeze. Wowee.
You can see why these guys had to be pretty young.
Yeah, without a doubt. So, I mean, it's probably the best time to ask, really, but. Why do you think the 100th Bomb Group are so revered?
Well, it's a few different factors. So I think first off, it was a group of really big characters. So I think you see that in Masters of the Air. You've got the likes of John Egan and Gail Clevin. And they are just kind of big personalities, big leaders, very popular characters. And that was really important actually during the war to kind of give their bomb group this kind of personality. But then also after the war, they were still very actively involved in the 100th Bomb Group Association, the group of veterans. They'd help organise reunions and kind of carry on this legend of the 100th.
Yes.
But going back to the early days of the 100th's involvement in the air war, they experienced these really huge losses. They weren't that by any means kind of the worst off group in the whole 8th Air Force. They didn't suffer the highest casualties, but during their first few missions in kind of summer autumn of 1943, they did suffer some really heavy losses on certain missions at Bremen, obviously at Regensburg, and then Bremen again, and then Munster. They had this really hard time. They also had quite a high turnover of different commanders, and they kind of had a reputation for not being perhaps the best organized group. They'd also often be the low squadron, so they'd be in the most vulnerable position. So kind of all of these factors really gave them this kind of hard luck reputation.
Yes.
But I really think it was at Munster on the 10th of October 1943 when they sent out 13 aircraft and only one made it back.
Yeah.
Royal Flush, piloted by Rosie Rosenthal. I think that really cemented the legend of the Bloody 100th. And then from then on, replacement crews would, if they found out they were going to the 100th, they would often. The reputation had preceded it. It kind of went on from there, and they also had some difficult missions in early 1944 as well.
It's incredible, you know. You see in the show it's the sort of losses that they're taking, and it's just, you think, surely they're going to crack, and they're going to, you know, not be able to go up again, but they do. It's incredible. It's incredible.
Yeah,
really, really is.
Absolutely.
So we have a question from one of our patrons, Jamie D. He asks, what's the biggest challenge you have in curating such a large, specialist and important collection? And does publicity from big projects such as Masters of the Air help or hinder your curating task?
That's a really good question. So I think first and foremost, one of the biggest challenges is making sure actually we're not seen as an aviation museum.
Yeah.
So even though we've got these amazing aircraft from the First World War all the way through to contemporary conflicts, we like to actually kind of include personal stories of the people who flew these planes or who worked on them, who are associated with them. So for each aircraft we have a showcase which tells the story of an individual who's associated with an aircraft. So for the B-17 we've got a kind of gunner story, we've got a pilot story. For the P-51 we've got the story of Huey Lamb, who is actually based here at Duxford and who flew with the 78th fighter group. So it's kind of trying to tell those personal emotional stories that people can connect to. That can be a bit of a challenge. Also telling the stories of people who maybe aren't as well represented in other collections. So 150,000 black Americans actually served in England during the Second World War, and many of those were based with the US Army Air Force building airfields. And despite thousands of men and women serving here, it's actually really difficult to find documentation and collections that relate to their story. So that's probably one of the greatest challenges. And also, when you're kind of dealing with all that, you've got to bear in mind that we're also a memorial to these men and women who served here and who didn't get to go back to the States. So we've got to bear that in mind as well and make sure that we're kind of telling their story, but also commemorating them. It's a very complex role, but hugely enjoyable, and I'm just so lucky to work with this incredible collection.
Without a doubt. Matt, I think you've got some questions, haven't you?
So, Hattie, how did the 8th and the US Army Air Force in general, how did their tactics actually develop during the war?
It was, it kind of came about through a few different factors. I think the most important thing about the 8th Air Force and the tactics was that they were very versatile, and it all really began back even before the war with the Bomber Mafia, who was a group of US Army kind of intellects who came up with this idea that the bomber would always get through. So if you had a doctrine of high altitude precision bombing, bombers, mainly the B-17, would be able to operate that in daytime, in daylight, and always be able to make it back. And obviously, in practice, this was a highly flawed concept, and as soon as they got into the European theatre, they realised that actually it was much more difficult than they thought. So they had to adapt their tactics. Probably one of the most pivotal moments was the development of the combat box formation. So whereas before, kind of 1942, bombers were flying in like V formations, which left them very vulnerable to attack. They weren't really in a good position to defend themselves. Curtis LeMay, who was one of the bomb group commanders, came up with this idea of the combat box. So elements would form up into squadrons, would form up into groups, and they would kind of take on this box-like formation, and these boxes would be staggered every few miles and at different altitudes. And this helped the bombers to defend themselves, and it also meant that they lowered the risk of actually dropping bombs on their own formations, which was obviously important.
Oh, yeah.
So that was an example of how tactics changed. The next real big change came in late 1943, early 1944, when Jimmy Doolittle, who'd just taken over command of the 8th Air Force, developed some new fighter tactics. So this at this moment, the P-51 Mustang kind of came to the fore, and the P-51 had the range to take the bombers all the way to their targets, which was a massive game changer for the 8th Air Force. And Doolittle came up with a new tactic where he basically let the fighters loose. They no longer had to be chained to the bombers. They could actually go ahead of the formation and attack the Luftwaffe fighters who were waiting for the bombers. And then on the way back, if they had the opportunity to, they could attack ground targets, airfields, and kind of other important installations. So that had a huge impact on actually helping the Allies to gain superiority in the air, which would be huge leading up to D-Day and beyond. So yeah, tactics really evolved with changing technologies and vice versa.
Sure.
So I think that was one of the 8th Air Force's greatest strengths, its ability to adapt under different circumstances.
Massively. Obviously, as you're going forward, you get more bombers, so you can do more things.
Exactly,
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
So our next question is from AD Bond. He asks, what's the process for crew selection once Air Force personnel had arrived in the UK?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question because often we don't really touch upon how these crews were actually put together. So whereas in the RAF, you kind of have a much more organic crew selection process. So bomber personnel were all kind of chucked into a big hangar and kind of just left to sort themselves out into different groups and different crews.
Yeah, you do hear that, don't you?
Yeah.
You'll be the gunner, you'll be
basically,
the...
Basically. Yeah. But in the US Army Air Force, it was much more scientific. So crews were assigned by commanders, and it was done after having kind of gone through different interviews, and people were assessed based on their personality types and also their different capabilities, and then they were put into crews that way. They also considered people's demographics, so they liked to have a mix of people. They didn't like to have two people from the same hometown, for example. So it was a much more scientific approach, and to be honest, it did work most of the time. Crews tended to gel. There were instances where people had to be transferred out because they just weren't working well together. But the main aim was to create a crew that could work well, basically like a machine, and they had to be able to do that in a B-17 because teamwork was essential.
So
crews would be formed in the States, and then they would usually fly their bomber over to England. But you did obviously have replacement crew, gunners as well, who would often travel over on the Queen Mary and then would be assigned to different bomb groups when they're in the UK.
Wow. Yeah. Matt, you got another question, I think.
So we're here in the nose of the aircraft, in the navigator's position. Is there a position that you would have least liked to have manned if you'd been a member of a B-17 crew?
Yeah, I mean, that is another really good question. I think we often think of the ball turret gunner as being the most vulnerable position, and certainly you can make a case that that would be the worst position. You're kind of in this fetal position for maybe up to 8 hours, and you're quite isolated. And again, with the tail gunner as well, you're in a very isolated position at the back of the aircraft, very uncomfortable. You're sitting on this kind of bicycle seat. But actually, when you look at survivability rates, the ball turret gunner was certainly not the worst on the aircraft, which is quite surprising. The waist gunner position, you had actually a much greater chance of being killed or wounded in that position. And that is really because you're very vulnerable to strafing from enemy fighters. Yeah. There's not really that much armour plating there. And you're also kind of standing in front of a giant window in your aircraft.
Yeah, obviously.
That has implications as well for just comfort, because you're facing winds of up to 200 miles per hour, temperatures of up to minus 50 below. So it's not the nicest of places to be. So I think the waist gunner position would probably be my least favourite. Although, saying that, you could also make a case for the bombardier's position, where we're sitting right now, because you're extremely vulnerable to frontal attacks from enemy aircraft, and you've also got this huge responsibility. So the whole bomber's mission is to put the bombs on the target, and that comes down to you when you're on the bomb run. So you've got to be focused on getting those bombs on the target during the most harrowing, most scary part of the mission. So, yeah, bombardier is probably a close second for me.
Wow.
I suppose the obvious follow-up on that is, what position would you have liked to have manned?
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go for glory and go for the pilot's position. You're the commander of the ship. You've got 10 people's lives in your hand. Hands. I mean, it's a scary prospect. You're the one that's given the order to bail out if you need to, and you're the one with the responsibility to bring your plane back home safely. So there's a lot riding on it. But then you've also got that kind of cool status as the commander of the plane. Yeah. A lot of people would be looking up to you. So I think I'd go with pilot.
Yeah. And you get to tell everyone you're a pilot too.
Yeah, yeah, of cool. course. I guess you get all the ladies, I imagine. Yeah. So yeah, it's
very true.
It's pretty cool.
So now me and Matt have had a bit of a debate about this in the last week or so, and we thought we'd spring it on you just for the reaction. When you're on the plane and you want to go
8 hours in,
you know, you've just gone to Germany, you're on your way home, what do you do if you need the loo on board?
Yeah, that's actually a really common question.
I bet it is.
Yeah.
So some RAF bombers, they actually had a little toilet that you could use. It wasn't really recommended. As you can imagine, turbulence didn't really owe itself to going to the loo. But the B-17 didn't have anything like that. You were given a relief tube, so it was like kind of a glass tube that you could do your business in, and then often just pour that out. Or if you were really caught short and you needed a number two, there was a bucket situation. But that definitely really wasn't very favorable. You also had a lot of ammo cases,
of course.
Ammo boxes you could use. Exactly. But often, I mean, in the actual middle of combat, when maybe you needed to go the most because you're absolutely scared out of your wits, some crews just had to go,
of course,
in their heated flying suits. And actually, there's a lot of cases where the heated electrically heated flying suits would short circuit because crews had gone to the loo in them.
Yeah, that was in episode 1.
Yes,
isn't it?
And that would cause frostbite and all sorts. So definitely not recommended. Also, there's quite a few cases of the ball turret gunner getting a bit annoyed, because often crews would use the bomb bay as a toilet, but as you can imagine, the urine would then hit back straight into the ball turret, and that would cloud their vision, and it's just not pleasant.
No.
So yeah, it was a very important thing to consider, because these guys were up in the air for up to kind of 8, even 10 hours.
Of course, working day. You know.
Exactly, you're going to need the loo.
Well, I owe Matt a fiver now, because I was thinking, oh, well, they might have had a system, you know. So Matt was right, he said through the bomb pit to us. Yeah. So we have another question from Westerly Owl, and he asks, what productions have been used at Duxford?
Yes, so most famously, going back to 1968, the Battle of Britain film was filmed here, very famously. And actually, there was an interesting story around that. So as part of the scene, I think the airfield's coming under attack, and one of the hangars is blown up.
Yes.
And that actually did happen in real life here at Duxford. One of our First World War hangars was blown up during the production. I believe that actually the production company didn't seek permission from Duxford to do that.
That's quite infamous, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a massive shame, because that hangar actually had a lot of history attached to it. So during the Second World War, whilst the 78 fighter group are based here, that hangar is used as the base theatre. So you have the likes of Bing Crosby and Bob Hope all performing in that hangar. So it's a shame we don't have it now. We've just got the concrete base there where it would have sat. But kind of that actually had big implications on the history of Duxford. So after that demolition, huge efforts were made to secure the future of Duxford Airfield, and it became listed, and the Imperial War Museum took it over to run it as a museum. So we do owe quite a lot to that production.
Ironically,
very ironically. But more recently, the airfield was used as the filming location for an upcoming film, 6888, which is
Tyler Perry Netflix series.
Yeah. So it tells the story of the 6888 Postal Battalion, and they were actually a battalion of black American women. They were the only unit of black American women to serve overseas during the Second World War, and they were based here in England, in Birmingham, and they were tasked with sorting through 3 years' worth of mail and for distribution to the troops in Europe, and they managed to do that task exceptionally well. They got through the whole backlog within 6 months. We do tell their story here at Duxford in the American Air Museum, and so that's one that we're really looking forward to actually coming out.
That's going to be a good one.
Yeah,
it's been amazing talking to you, Hattie, inside of B-17. I think this is the first Fighting on Film episode to be recorded on location, and what better location than a B-17?
Yeah,
it's amazing. So thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Wonderful experience. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. And I'm going to do the outro in the B-17,
of course,
next to the bomb site. Amazing. So make sure you follow us on the socials, leave us a review wherever you listen to us, and we'll catch you again for more war movie fun on Fighting on Film.
And I'll also add, definitely come and check out the museum here at the IWM Duxford to get a look at Sally B.
Yeah, please do. Thanks for joining us, Hattie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.